Rolls Royce, mister. I don't want your pleasure yacht. All I want, just food for my baby, is to me my old job back.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, news director of Progressive News Network, and I'd like to introduce my associate, Miss Renee Shaker, associate producer of the show. Renee, hello.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us.
I'll tell you, we have one heck of a show for you tonight. Some really important people, some really important ideas, and now the news. You know, first things first, there's a lot of talk about this. Are we spying on everybody all the time or not? Well, we've got some interesting thoughts on that, too. But first, some announcements. Congresswoman Frederica Wilson's got a congressional update at the community forum. That'll be Monday, June 10th. That's hosted by the 93rd Street Community Baptist Church at 2330 Northwest 93rd Street, Miami. We've got an action alert from South Florida Congresswoman. Join moms at press conference to call on Governor Scott to veto House Bill 655. Tuesday, June 11th at 10 a.m., South Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz will join moms, community and labor activists, and workers at a press conference to call upon Governor Scott to veto HB 655. 655 is a disastrous bill that tramples on home rule, preempting local ordinances like earned sick time. People should not be forced to go without pay or be fired because they need to leave work to care for a sick child or a family member, and no one should be forced to work when they are ill, putting every Floridian at risk. HB 655 is scheduled to be on the governor's desk any day now. You have your role. We know what that is. You know the rule. Hey, contact them. Let them know what you think and that you do. And one more thing on the news front. We got All People's Day Diversity Festival friends. This year, our back-to-school clothing drive fundraiser will be held in coordination with the Spirit of Giving Network's back-to-school bash on Saturday, August 10th, so you got some time to plan for that. At the Village Academy in Delray, there will be an attached flyer if you contact them. Families with at-risk kids from 32 nonprofits can get a whole shopping cart full of kids' clothes for a donation of only $5. All proceeds go toward the free 2014 All People's Day Diversity Festival. For kids' clothing, pick up and call Ellen at 561-883-5624 or Sharon, get your pencils ready, Sharon at 561-752-0652. We'll repeat these numbers at the end of the show. Spirit of Giving will be also providing free school supplies, backpacks, uniforms, and more. Help make the start of the next school year a great one for low-income families by supporting diversity. You heard it here, Progressive News Network. Let's see. We've also got this news story. We are being watched. How corporations and law enforcement are spying on environmentalists. February 2010, Tom Junta and a small group of residents in Northeast Florida formed the Gas Drilling Awareness Coalition, an environmental organization opposed to hydraulic fracturing in this region. The group sought to appeal to the widest possible audience and was careful about striking a moderate tone. All members were asked to sign a code of conduct in which they pledged to carry themselves with professionalism, dignity, and kindness as they work to protect the environment and their communities. GDAC's founders acknowledged that gas drilling had become a divisive issue, misrepresented by individuals on both sides, and they agreed to seek out the truth. This group of about 10 professionals, engineers, nurses, teachers, began meeting in the basement of a member's homes, and as their numbers grew, they moved to a local church in an effort to raise public awareness about the risks of hydraulic fracturing or fracking. They attended township meetings, zoning and ordinance hearings, and gas drilling forums. They invited speakers from other states affected by gas drilling to talk with Pennsylvania residents. They held house party-style screenings of documentary films. Since this group had never engaged in any kind of illegal activity, particularly radical forms of protest, it came as a shock when GDAC members learned that their organization had been featured in an intelligence bulletin compiled by a private security firm. The Institute of Terrorism Research and Response. Equally shocking was the revelation that the Pennsylvania Department of Homeland Security had distributed these bulletins to local police chiefs, state, federal, and private intelligence agencies, and the security directors of the national gas companies, as well as industry groups and public relations firms. News of the surveillance broke in September 2010 when the director of Pennsylvania Department of Homeland Security, James Powers, mistakenly sent an email to an anti-drilling activist he believed was sympathetic to the industry, warning her not to post the bulletin online. The activist was Virginia Cody, a retired Air Force officer. In his email to Cody, Powers wrote, "We want to continue providing the support to the Marcellus Shale Formation natural gas stakeholders while not feeding those groups fomenting dissent against those same companies." The tri-weekly bulletin featured a wide range of supposed threat to the state's infrastructure. It included warnings about Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, pro-life activists, Tea Party protesters. The bulletins also included information about when and where the groups like GDAC would be meeting, upcoming protests, anti-fracking activist internal strategies. The raw data was followed by a threat assessment, low, moderate, severe, or critical, and a brief analysis. For example, bulletin number 118, dated July 30th, 2010, gave a low to moderate threat rating in reference to public meetings that the anti-drilling activists plan to attend and suggested that an attack is likely and might well be executed. The threat assessment was accompanied by this note: "The escalating conflict over natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania may define local fault lines and potentially increase area environmentalist activity or eco-terrorism. GDAC communications have cited northeastern Pennsylvania counties, especially Wyoming County, Lackawanna County, and Lucerne County as being in real need of help and facing a drastic situation." You could see how these nurses and other professionals could be a real threat to Homeland Security. But remember, keep in mind, we're not being monitored. It's not really, we're not really being monitored. It's just the metadata. You know, the stuff you'd get on your meter reading, just the information of, whatever you're doing and wherever you're going and who you're talking to. Okay. Yeah, you know, the show today is going to be focused on the TPP. And in just a few minutes, I'm going to have our friend Renee Shaker give you the lowdown on the TPP. But right now, first, you know, our good friend Senator Warren has once again made some really fantastic comments, things that you want to know about. So let me play this little piece of Senator Warren talking about scholarships and how we should hold the line.
Mr. President.
The Senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President, there are only 3 weeks left until interest rates on new subsidized student loans will double. If we fail to act, the cost of college will increase for millions of students. There are strong proposals on the table that would keep interest rates low while Congress has time to work out a permanent solution, and yet Congress fails to act. Why? Two issues: money and values. First, money. Some have argued that we can't afford to keep interest rates low. But let's be clear. Right now, the federal government is making a profit from our students. Just last month, the Congressional Budget Office calculated that the government will make $51 billion this year off student loans. Think about that. $51 billion. And that's $16 billion higher than the earlier estimate. We have the money to cut interest rates if we're willing to reduce the profits we make from our students. Unfortunately, Republicans see it differently. 2 weeks ago, House Republicans passed a plan that would produce higher profits off the backs of our college students. And here in the Senate, Senator Coburn has introduced a similar bill that makes student loans more profitable, all at the expense of our college students. This is wrong. We should reject Republican plans to make more profits off our students. Now, Senator Coburn talks about how his plan is similar to the low interest rate banks offer through the Federal Reserve, but he's got that wrong. The big banks borrow at less than 1%, but Senator Coburn would charge students an additional 3% on top of the 10-year Treasury rates. His plan would produce billions more in profits for the government, money that comes straight out of the pockets of our struggling students. We have the money to help our students. We just don't need to squeeze them harder. The second issue is values. Our college students already see that the system is rigged against them. They watched Wall Street bankers get bailed out while their parents lost jobs and struggled to hang on to their homes. They see special subsidies for companies that ship jobs overseas and exploit tax loopholes, while the investments in their future, in jobs at home, disappear. And now Senator Coburn plans to squeeze more profits out of our students. He's fine with the government handing out loans to big banks at incredibly low rates, but he wants our students to pay more. That's not who we are. This does not reflect our values. We see students drowning in debt, and we should be there to help. Senator Harkin and Senator Reid have shown great leadership on this issue. They offer a simple solution to prevent interest rates from doubling. Their plan would maintain the current 3.4% interest rate for two more years. I've also introduced a short-term plan that would cut interest rates even more by offering the exact same rate that the big banks get through the Federal Reserve discount window. I introduced this one-year deal because we need immediate relief while we develop a long-term plan. So I rise today in support of Senator Reid and Senator Harkin's proposal to freeze interest rates on subsidized loans for two more years. Their proposal prevents the rates from doubling on July 1st, and it also gives us time to develop a plan that aligns with our values and supports our students. You know, this really is about our values. Have we become a people who will support our big banks with nearly free loans while we crush our kids who are trying to get an education? The student loan program makes obscene profits on the backs of our students. This is morally wrong, and we must put a stop to it. You know, our students don't have high-paid lobbyists to look out for their interests, but they do have their voices. Petitions urging Congress to pass a short-term plan for interest rates to prevent them from doubling have already collected more than 1 million signatures. Our students and their families are asking for what is right. They are asking for something we can easily afford. Let's show them that government can work for them. Thank you, Mr. President.
And that was Senator Elizabeth Warren talking about the student loan program and how the rates are about to double. So if you have a child in college or you understand the importance of these low-cost student loans, I want you to give her a call of support and call your senator and make sure he or she is going to support this measure. Ladies and gentlemen, I think I have Mr. Pallast here. Let me check. Good evening. Is that you, Greg? Good evening. Is that you, Greg? Okay, well, we'll give them a minute and see if they wander back to the microphone. We have a wonderful set of guests tonight that Renee has arranged for us. In addition to Greg Pallast, we have also a interview with Representative Alan Grayson, who's going to talk about the TPP. We also have Lorraine Tulliano, and she and Jim Howe are going to give us the labor perspective. Renee has the details on that. And then we've got Miss Alyssa Simmons coming in to talk about the consumer watch group I'm sorry, Renee.
Public Citizen. She's National Field Director for Global Trade Watch. This is the arm of a Public Citizen that has been tracking trade issues. A lot of good stuff on NAFTA, and they've been monitoring the Trans-Pacific Partnership as well. They have a whole website devoted to this. We'll pass out some information when we talk a little bit more and have Alyssa on our show.
Okay.
So we've got three really good people. Marjorie Holt from the Sierra Club was supposed to join us, but unfortunately illness has detained her. But we do have the remarks and the fact sheets from the Sierra Club and the impact that the TPP is going to have on the environment and in particular fracking in this country.
Well, I thought I had Greg Palast on, but evidently he's not there yet. So let me go ahead and deliver a bit more news for you. You'll be, I'm sure, totally surprised to know that on the one hand, while the UN Atomic Radiation Agency has, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you, we've got the charming and talented, the internationally famed journalist, Mr. Greg Palast. Greg, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good, sir. Hello. Very good.
Okay.
So tell us, sir, what have you been working on lately?
Evil. Evil. There's evil afoot and the smell of mendacity. I don't want to tell, you know, please, I just want you to be prepared for this, but your president hasn't been telling you the full truth. Says he is given up the, he's getting off his addiction to drones. He's sworn off drones. He's giving it, he's in rehab. In fact, he set up a new drone base in the nation of Niger. Now, if you don't know where the nation of Niger is, you're not supposed to, because this is right. Remember that most Americans do not learn. And by the way, it's the capital is Niamey, which we don't learn the capitals of these nations until the 82nd Airborne arrives. You know, like Mogadishu, Kabul, Saigon. Whoever heard of these places, right?
It's those postcards.
And,
right,
exactly. So, get ready for the 82nd Airborne in Niamey. What's happened is that when we had the French ran into the Sahara, French
right.
Foreign Legion, old style imperial operation to save the Malian dictatorship. And so what was that all about? Well, that was, and then they opened up a drone base. Obama said, well, an exception to my no drone rule is the new base in Niger. Why was that? The answer is uranium. And that the French have two uranium mines in Niger next to Mali. And we were told that the drones were to stop Al-Qaeda from attacking Niger as a spillover from Mali and Libya. But that's all reversed because starting in 2010, Al-Qaeda was attacking the French uranium mines in Niger and capturing French engineers, etc. Now, why do we care about the uranium mines of Niger that the French are holding? That's because the company that is mining the hot junk, is a company named Areva. Areva has been named as it was just given a license by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to build one of the four new nuclear plants approved by the Obama administration. We all thought that nuclear power was, kind of like dead, but it's come back from the crypt with massive, massive government guarantees. Well, your for or against nuclear power is not the point. This is kind of bailout in advance. They put out $8 billion in loan guarantees to companies like this French company, Areva, to build nuclear plants in the U.S. By the way, one of the four license winners, by the way, who just pulled out because they didn't have a lot of money, was a company called Tokyo Electric Power. But they ran into a little problem in Fukushima. And believe it or not, Tokyo Electric was picked because of, and I'm quoting from the from the administration because of their extraordinary experience in operating boiling water nuclear reactors. Yeah, it's extraordinary, all right. You know, if so basically we got the guys from Fukushima, the Japanese from Fukushima, and we've got the Frenchmen from Niger stealing uranium from Africa. And by the way, those people who think that nuclear power is nice and clean and green, that means you've never been to a uranium plant mine, you know, which is, you know, the usual filth of a mine.
Much less downriver.
Plus radioactivity. Right. And, we've seen these problems. I went to a uranium mine, ex-uranium mine area in the native lands, native pueblos in New Mexico, where, you know, nothing grows there. And, of course, you don't want anything to grow anymore because you wouldn't want to eat it. Because radioactive. And so, you know, it's destructive, it's horrible, the usual stuff. And, of course, it's a magnet for terrorists. As soon as you open up uranium mines, I mean, what could be more tempting? So the reason I mention this, if you want to have a nuclear power program, you better have a big drone program, too. Because you're going to have to deal with Niger, you're going to have to cut deals with Al-Qaeda in the Sahel, or you get to deal with Russia, which is the biggest supplier of uranium. And, you know, I know that George Bush looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and found him to be a sincere man. Now, I've never looked into Putin's eyes because I wouldn't dare. But you know, if that's the guy you want uranium from. So the idea is that we're supposed to get – let's not be dependent anymore on Arab nations or Venezuela for our oil. Let's depend on, you know, these desert dictatorships in Africa – Kazakhstan. I was just in Kazakhstan. Believe me, you don't want to get your uranium from there. And Russia. That's our uranium supplies. And, you know, it's not – so that's the price if we're going to start messing around with nuclear power. And somehow the – it's again, it's not about whether you're for or against nuclear power. It's just totally besides the point. It's all about you get into this business and you're going to have drones, armies, the whole thing. It's going to be – let's put it this way. If you liked the Blood for Oil wars, you'll love Blood for Uranium.
Oh, boy.
That's what I'm working on.
Wow, that's a ton of fun.
Yeah. So I was just in Kazakhstan, another nice place, you know.
Yeah.
And you really, let's put it this way. Well, at least you don't have to worry about dissidents or anything complaining about uranium mines, as you can well imagine. The old KGB chief has been is now the president of the Islamic Republic. So he went from being a good communist atheist to being a good Muslim. And the only difference is that he and his daughter control the uranium supplies and the oil. And the media, and of course, the police to make sure that they control the uranium and the oil and the media. And that's how it works.
Incredible.
So there you are. So, you know, and by the way, in case you're wondering, you don't remember the billions of dollars in guarantees for nuclear plants? Well, you forgot that there was in 2010, Obama sent an emergency request to Congress to fund an emergency cost for the wars in Iraq and Iran. It was billed as providing body armor, request for body armor, for mine-proof vehicles because the IEDs, and so you're going to have these new armor for the vehicles, body armor for the troops. At the bottom of this list, and the whole thing for all the troops and everything was about $357 million. You know, it's kind of spit in military terms. At the bottom of that was $8 billion for nuclear plants.
Really?
As part of the emergency bill for armor for the troops. You like that?
Yeah, that's that special deal. I see, you know, you're working on so many interesting stories. I see on your website that you have a story about the Chechens. You did some investigation in Kazakhstan.
Yep, and because I did a lot in Kazakhstan. I was able to meet with Karzai, the Afghanistan's foreign minister, I was able to meet with, you know, and so I did a lot of investigating. Part of it was that after the Boston bombings, you know, people talk, you know, well, why are these kids blowing up their neighbors over a place called Chechnya, which most of these people lost their legs had never even heard of, right? And the answer is that the Russians had slaughtered about a fifth of the population. There are about 1 million Chechens in this little teeny corner of at the bottom of Russia on the Caspian Sea. And the Chechens, who are the old Tartars, and they try to be independent of the Russian Empire for 1,000 years. And so they, when everyone else broke, and the Russians let everyone else go, the Soviets let everyone else go, they wouldn't let the Chechens go because they kind of hate them. And so they want to keep them underfoot. So when the Chechens rose up, there are about 1 million of them, they slaughtered, aerial bombing, bombardment of the big city in Chechnya, Grozny, and they killed 200,000 Chechens. It was a complete massacre of the civilian population. So these guys were really upset about that. And you'd say, well, why are they upset? It was the Russians that killed killed the people, their ethnic brethren and their families. Uh-huh. And the answer is that even though the U.S. had objected to, you know, Putin's slaughter, and the U.S. in fact had secretly armed groups to fight, look the other way while Saudis and others were supporting the Chechens, because the Chechens are Muslims, and the Russians, of course, tend to be Orthodox Christians. And so it was, again, another case like Afghanistan of an uprising of Muslims. And what happened was that it's just like the way we supported Osama bin Laden and his buddies in Afghanistan. The problem of terrorists, you give them guns, and, you know, they're like homing pigeons. They come home to roost, you know, and so, you know, you think you can arm the terrorists, and the problem is while the Russians were brutal, the people we did arm in Chechnya, just like in Afghanistan, were just pure murderers, killers. You can't tell these guys, okay, you can only make trouble over there. You can't come over here. The problem is that about half of the Chechen, maybe less than half of the Chechen insurgents decided that it wasn't Russia versus the Chechens, it was the Islamic world versus the, you know, everyone else, the Jews and the Christians who are out to get the Muslims. And therefore, it didn't matter who you attacked, whether it was Russia or the U.S. It was all part of this grand global battle. And these guys basically came out of this terrorist movement that we allowed to develop, and we had no problem with the Saudis arming these guys, and we looked the other way. And in fact, there was recruitment of teenage kids in the United States for the Chechen wars. So we started the recruitment program that brought these kids in. I don't know if they were part of it, but I actually did a report for BBC television. There was a kind of what I call, you know, Camp Terror, where they had an organization had a summer camp for kids in Florida, and they, you know, did the usual canoeing and baseball and whatever, and then they'd watch propaganda films and get recruited for the Chechen War. And one of the films I found that they were being shown was one about in which starring that what they called, quote, that compassionate young man, Osama bin Laden. Now, this group was controlled by a guy named Abdullah bin Laden, Osama's younger brother. And, you know, there are 52 brothers and sisters. And most of them, by the way, don't like Osama. But this guy was very much a kind of Osama. He liked his older brother. And he was living in the United States. And he was one of the people that right after September 11th, we let this guy take off.
Got the free pass, yeah.
Yeah, he got the do not go to jail free pass thing. And the problem was is that the FBI really, really wanted to talk to this guy. They wanted, and here's the important thing, they wanted to talk to him before the September 11th attack. I have a document that their investigation of Abdullah bin Laden was shut down well before September 11th. Actually, it was shut down, interestingly, under the Clinton administration, because Clinton was letting Abdullah and the bin Laden youth organization propagandize in the U.S., and recruit kids in the U.S. and all over the world to fight in Bosnia, which, you know, again, wink and nod. We let the Muslims nations support the war in Bosnia, and again in Chechnya, and this is left over from the fight in Afghanistan. And this is the problem. I was sympathetic to the Chechens. I was very sympathetic to the Bosnians. I was just in Bosnia last year. It was horrible. They were being slaughtered, no question. On the other hand, when you give terrorists weapons, they don't necessarily protect their people. They go looking for people to kill. And sometimes it ends up being your friends in Boston. And, you know, and then the U.S. like, how could this happen? How could this happen? Well, I guess when you arm terrorists, they sometimes use those weapons. They use their training. But they may not use it where you tell them to. They're not very cooperative. They're not little puppy dogs. You know, you can't say, oh, sit there. No, get off the couch. You know? No, please don't, you know. I remember Rudy Giuliani years ago on television. It made me sick because I checked it on YouTube and saw it again. Someone was asking and said, you know, we seem to be kind of supporting the Chechen insurgents. Isn't that dangerous? This was after September 11th. You know, Rudy was the big hotshot anti-terrorist expert. And he literally started giggling and says, they only bother the Russians. I would like Giuliani now to go to every family in Boston with an injured or dead person in their family and apologize for giggling about they only bother Russians. Really, Rudy? Really?
How many times are we going to make that mistake, huh?
You know, exactly. How many times, you know, we build or allow the creation of Frankenstein factories. And then we're wondering why the monsters run loose. Oh, my God, when they come back at us. You know, we thought maybe, you know, I think Americans may have thought it was, you know, the Bush administration may have thought it was very cute when Al-Qaeda killed basically every member of the Iranian mission in Afghanistan. You know, because the Iranians are Shia, and Al Qaeda is Sunni, and so they killed all the Iranians in Kabul in the Iranian mission. And you know, maybe Bush thought that was cute, and therefore didn't bother going after them. And you know, but it's not cute when you know because they don't exactly say, you know maintain. Again, we can't create Frankenstein factories and expect Frankensteins to pay attention to us. They don't respond to the remote controls. And like you say, we make the same mistake over and over. You know, and unfortunately, I don't know why. Maybe you have a better idea why we do it over and over, except that maybe the guys who are harmed that create the Frankenstein factories are not the guys who are harmed by the Frankensteins. You know, that they don't expect, you know, that. And in fact, you know, then they get to run around and save us from the terrorists. So, you know, so remember, once you had the Boston bombing, right, you know, suddenly we have a whole increase. Listen, we have to have machinery to now review every email ever sent by an American to their grandmother, right? We have to have that because we just had these people killed in Boston. Now, wait, they were killed in Boston because we were supporting Chechen terrorists, not because people were writing emails that we need to read. I never heard an FBI agent say to me, oh, we could have stopped September 11th if we only had the Patriot Act 2 years earlier. No, they all said if we were allowed to go after the Bin Laden family, if they hadn't shut down our investigation, the Bin Laden family, maybe we would have picked up something. I'm not saying it would have stopped the attack. I don't know. That's speculation. But, you know, it's pretty hard to see something when you aren't looking, as Yogi Berra would say. He used to say, you know, it's amazing what you can see when you look. Well, if you tell the agencies not to look, they're not going to see. You know, it's like, so this is what I've been working on. And, you know, so again, and you notice that there's this connection. You got the drones, the nuclear power, Kazakhstan is also oil, massive bribery in Kazakhstan. By the way, speaking of which, Bill Clinton showed up in Kazakhstan too, not just me.
Really?
On the jet, the corporate jet of a guy, of a billionaire out of Canada, who has been the number one supporter of the Clinton library, $200 million, almost $250 million to Clinton. Jeez. And his library. Clinton goes and meets the president of Kazakhstan. Then the guy goes and meets with the president of Kazakhstan 20 minutes later and gets a contract for Kazakhstan's uranium. Now, is there a connection? Clinton says he wasn't there to sell uranium. And then they fly off in the guy's jets to Colombia. And Clinton goes and meets the president of Colombia. And then the guy who flies him there then meets the president of Colombia and suddenly gets an oil concession. Again, Clinton says, I have nothing to do with that. He's just, you know, I'm just taking a lift on the plane. All right, you know, but, you know, it's, you know, I've been to these nations. When you go, I was just in Kazakhstan. When you go to the president of Kazakhstan and Bill Clinton comes and shakes your hand and says, I want you to meet my good friend here. And then good friend says, listen, you know, good friends give each other mineral concessions. You know, it's like, it's a pretty good introduction when the introduction is from, don't forget, not just the ex-president of the United States, but the current, at that time, current Secretary of State.
Yeah.
Right? The husband of the Secretary of State of the United States is introducing guys who are cutting resource deals. Now, do you think that the president of Kazakhstan might be a bit confused? Let's say it's all totally honest. That there's no selling of influence, none. Let's just assume that. Let's just assume we're that stupid, okay? But let's just assume that. That's a heck of a way. You know, that's quite, can be quite confusing to a head of state when the former president of the United States shows up, who's husband of the current Secretary of State, and says, "Gee, my friend here, we really like your uranium." The guy, you know, the president of Kazakhstan, no matter what he feels, may feel like, well, that may be a pretty difficult thing to say no to. Or he may feel like, I'm going to get myself a lot of friendship here. You know, that's one thing, man. If Hillary decides to run, and I'm not just picking on Democrats. It may sound like I'm picking on Democrats.
No,
right?
Not at all.
And this thing. I mean, you know, usually I'm, and, you know, I'll tell you, like Catherine Harris does, you know, they say, oh, I'm partisan, I'm pro-Democratic. Now you listen to this and you think, oh, I hate the Democrats. No, I just, these guys in power, Democrat, Republican, you know, they are, you know, they think that they are selling the political authority of the United States. And that's their commodity. And that's, and so in a way, I'm only studying one subject, the sale of influence. That's what I'm studying. But, it, you know, sometimes it's nuclear power and drones, and sometimes it's oil, uranium, terrorism. It's the same story. One story.
You know, let me raise another topic that you've been working on that's so critical to our democracy. I noticed that you're looking at the Supreme Court and the potential decision coming up on voting rights.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I was working at Southern Christian Leadership Conference. One of the problems is, look, the most basic right of any American is to vote. And we care about not only our vote, but our votes are nullified if other people don't get to vote, right? Then what does it mean? You know, if the politicians pick and choose which votes are going to count, we all lose. What I'm worried about now is that the Supreme Court is going to say all the problems of the South. Just so you know what's at stake, this week we expect the Supreme Court to rule on the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Which basically gave black people the right to vote. Under that liberal lefty president, Ronald Reagan, the Voting Rights Act was massively expanded. He gave it about an increase. He gave it a 500% increase in reach, Ronald Reagan, to expand it to states where there's all kinds of prejudice, including against Hispanic and Native voters. So several states, Alaska, New York, California, Reagan's own state, were put under the Voting Rights Act, what's called the preclearance provision. If you're going to change voting procedures, you have to send a note to the federal government saying we're changing procedures, and this will have no effect on racial patterns. It's not going to deny any person of color their right to vote. Okay, so, you know, Bloomberg, New York City mayor, I don't really like the guy, but he wrote a note to the Supreme Court saying, I have to pre-clear everything, a big deal. I send a note, and that's that. Now, the Supreme Court is taking the position, some members of the court, and we'll see how it shakes out, Scalia and others, are saying, well, you know, the days of Jim Crow are over, and black people and brown people don't have any problem voting. Well, I have a two-word answer for that guy. Catherine Harris. It's different than the old days. Politicians don't deny black people the right to vote because they care about the color of their skin. They care about the color of their vote, okay? So that in the case of Catherine Harris, I discovered that she had, for example, in 2000, I uncovered that she had called 56,000 people, most of them black people, called them felons, criminals who can't vote in Florida, and none of them, and I want to emphasize this, not one of them was a illegal voter, not one out of 56,000. George Bush became president with 536 votes in Florida. Basically, it was this game with the voter rolls, calling people felons and stopping them from voters, that elected George Bush. Whether you like Bush as president or not doesn't matter to me. Whether you like Gore or not doesn't matter to me. I mean, though the idea of President Gore kind of gives me the shakes, you know, but okay. He did win. Most of the people of Florida voted for him, and it's not a very good idea when America has a system in which computers are purging the voter rolls, stopping people from voting, and so computers are picking our president, and computer games are picking our president instead of the voters. And I'm afraid that this business will be endorsed by the Supreme Court, and it continued on. We have the current governor of Florida, a guy named Rick Scott. And by the way, you can read all this at gregpalast.com, GREGPALAST.com. I got a little film there. Rick Scott, the governor, accused 180,000 Floridians of being illegal aliens who are voting, registered to vote. Now understand, if you're an illegal alien and you're registered to vote, even if you're an legal alien registered to vote, you go to jail. If you get caught, you go to jail, and then you get deported. It's automatic. Every single alien who's ever been caught registering to vote or voting, everyone, no exception, has gone to jail and been deported. 180,000 voters were targeted for removal. Because of the Voting Rights Act last year, he was told he could not do that until he first proves that these really are illegal aliens or alien voters, non-citizens. Well, they found two. Out of 180,000, they found two. One was an Austrian who had registered as Republican. They arrested him. He's in prison, and in 2 years he'll be released and deported permanently. The second, though, they found was actually a Marine serving in Iraq, but he hadn't become a citizen yet, but he is a Marine serving in Iraq, so they decided not to arrest him. But that's just two out of 180,000. It's only because of that Obama won the state of Florida this past November. Now, I don't care whether Obama wins or loses the state of Florida. The important thing is that we don't determine what the vote should be based on games and computers picking out Hispanic names and saying, oh, obviously Jose Hernandez, he must be an illegal alien. That's the game that's being played. And the problem is that the Supreme Court, guys like Scalia saying, There's no more prejudice against black voters in the South. It's not about their feeling. It's about what they are actually doing. And that was what Reagan did. He changed the law from the reason why Reagan expanded the law to all these states and kept it in the South. Reagan said it's not about whether someone is prejudiced against someone because of their race. It's about the effect of what they're doing. It's the effect. So political manipulation counts. Even if they love black people, even if Catherine Harris dances cheek to cheek with P. Daddy, right? It doesn't matter. The important thing is that these activities are denying Americans the right to vote. I talked to one black war veteran, Willie Steen. The guy went, he's a war veteran, unlike our current president or past several presidents, and he was denied the right to vote because they called him a felon. This is complete baloney. Then after he lost his vote, couldn't vote, they sent him a letter saying, Catherine Harris sent him a letter saying, I'm so sorry. Yes, sure she was sorry. That's the problem we're running into. So don't forget, that's not different from the issue of drones in Niger, because once a president or a congressman thinks that they don't have to win by getting your vote, they just have to win by screwing around with the voting machine, and the computers, they don't care what they do. They don't care how you feel about intercepting your email. because they don't need your vote. They just need to manipulate whether your vote gets counted. That's dangerous.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Thanks for giving us an update on what you're working on. And, Greg, tell them where they can go to find more of your information and your books.
Once again, my latest book is Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, so you can get to meet these guys, you know, the Koch brothers and the rest of them, and Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. But the place to go is GregPalast.com, GregPalast.com, or BallotBandits.org, BallotBandits.org. Anyway, I really appreciate the chance to speak to you about this stuff. And right now I'm going off to see my cameraman new film on the war on terror in error called Dirty Wars. And I'll report back on that if you have me back on sometime soon.
Count on it, buddy. Thanks again.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Safe trip. Okay, friends, that was Greg Palast.
Well, we're as Florida residents, we're certainly no stranger to what Rick Scott did in the last election. I love the busloads of people being shipped around the state crying voter fraud to try to keep people from voting. So it's more than just the machines that are being manipulated.
That's for sure. Renee, why don't you tell people, give them that overview they're going to need to understand the TPP issue.
Okay, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. This is an expansive trade agreement being negotiated between the United States and right now 11 Pacific Rim countries, including Australia, Canada, Chile, Mexico, New Zealand, Vietnam, and a handful of others. And the TPP is intended to be a docking agreement for other countries in the Pacific Rim, which means others can join when they want. And right now, Japan has announced intentions to join the talks. Now, there's a lot of things everybody should know about the TPP, but in a nutshell, this is a raw deal. It's a raw deal for the U.S., it's a raw deal for labor, it's a raw deal for the environment. And it's a raw deal for our government as well. And we do have some guests that are going to go into all the details here. But one of the things that the TPP has been called is NAFTA on steroids. So I thought what I would do is take a couple minutes and look at what NAFTA has done, since this is, in many respects, the model for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Well, it's NAFTA was negotiated in 1993, and we have a lot of evidence in now as to what the effects could be. After 19 years of NAFTA, we can measure its actual outcomes, and the grand promises made by its proponents not only remain unfulfilled, but many of the outcomes are exactly the opposite of what was promised. For instance, one of the things that was touted was that NAFTA was going to give us a huge trade surplus. In reality, we had a U.S. trade deficit with Canada of $29 billion and a $2.5 billion surplus with Mexico in 1993, the year NAFTA took effect. Since then, we have turned this into a combined trade deficit of $181 billion by 2012. Another of NAFTA's promises was that this was supposed to slow the export of jobs in manufacturing. However, this too has turned out to be a false claim. Manufacturing and service exports in particular grew slower after NAFTA, and the Economic Policy Institute estimates that the rising trade deficit with Mexico and Canada since NAFTA went into effect eliminated about 1 million net jobs in the United States, and this was only by 2004. The ballooning trade deficit with Mexico alone destroyed about 700,000 net jobs, and this is through 2010. Government data reveals that nearly 5 million U.S. manufacturing jobs have been lost overall since NAFTA took effect. Most of these from NAFTA, but also due to China joining the World Trade Organization. As a result, service sector jobs have also been negatively impacted by NAFTA, as closed factories no longer demand services. The government also tried to determine the jobs that were created by NAFTA rather than destroyed. The Department of Commerce established such a program to look at this, but after finding fewer than 1,500 specific jobs that could be attributed to NAFTA, the program was shut down because its findings were so bleak. Another promise made was that this would help workers in the United States overall in terms of our wage structure. That is a big, big disappointment. After exporting so many jobs, and the only jobs that were available for these ex-manufacturing employees to take were in the service sector, it's been estimated that these workers who went back and found jobs in the service sector had to take a minimum of a 20% haircut in their wages. This also had the effect of flooding the market for service sector jobs and decreasing the wages for the entire economy. This shift in employment from high-paying manufacturing jobs to low-paying service jobs has contributed to the overall wage stagnation in this country. The average U.S. wage has grown less than 1% annually in real terms in the 19 years since NAFTA, as worker productivity has risen at more than three times that pace. And of course, all of this, as we know, has led to an exacerbation of the wage inequality that we have. Since NAFTA's implementation, the share of national income collected by the richest 10% has risen by 18%, while the top 1% share has shot up by nearly 40%. But probably one of the biggest damages that NAFTA has done, and this is going to be repeated under the TPP, is that corporations were given special new rights and privileges, which eliminated many of the risks and costs that had been associated with relocating production to lower wage venues. Not only has NAFTA made it more cost effective for companies to transfer jobs overseas, but it has also set up these special tribunals that corporations can take their grievances to if they feel that they've been harmed under NAFTA, if their profitability has been affected. Basically, what this does is this has tied the hands of local governments and state governments to enact regulations related to worker safety, the environment, drug costs, a whole host of issues that have nothing to do with trade. And these corporations can then come back and sue, claiming that their profits have been adversely impacted by these regulations. And to date, there have been about $350 million that the U.S. has had to pay out to these foreign corporations for violations under these sovereign investor tribunals that were set up under NAFTA. We have some really good guests here that we're going to have on that's going to talk a little bit more about the impact of the TPP. But I think before we get into that, Rick, we've got a little piece that Congressman Grayson did. There was a meeting up in Orlando last month on the TPP, and why don't we get started with that, and then after that I'll come back and I'll introduce our guests.
Here it goes.
In all seriousness, what this amounts to is giving away our sovereignty as Americans in exchange for nothing. Get nothing out of it. And it's shocking that something like this is even under consideration. Look at the history that we're starting to hear. NAFTA. The North American Free Trade Agreement has led to the loss of millions of jobs in the United States and done something that you wouldn't even think is possible. It's managed to impoverish both American and Mexican workers at the same time. The only ones who benefited from that are the multinational corporations who are going to get cheaper American labor. lost millions of manufacturing jobs because of NAFTA. And in Mexico, millions of farm workers have been forced off their own farms because of cheap corn flooding into Mexico and preventing them from being able to make their own corn at the price they can live on. So people have had to move off of the farms in Mexico and forced into further cheap labor supply to undermine our own standards. That's the result of NAFTA. And because of NAFTA and the World Trade Organization agreements that we've already entered into, we have already in existence the beginning of the cudgel that corporations can use to beat us down on health standards, on labor standards, on environmental standards, on every standard that we want to create collectively as Americans. And that's already happened. I can give you some examples of that. It was mentioned before that there are many cases that are pending. Some cases have already been resolved. One of those cases involves the fact that dolphins tend to be in the same general vicinity in the ocean as tuna because they eat tuna. Dolphins, in general, are endangered species. And extensive efforts were made by governments on behalf of environmentalists in order to prevent the capture of tuna, resulting in the death of dolphins. So what you need to do in order to prevent that is to make nets that catch the tuna but don't catch the dolphins. So governments have made rules, including our government around the world, in order to enforce the rules on fishermen to have nets that are dolphin-safe nets. Well, the fishing companies didn't like that. They sued under the WTO rules, and they won. So our own rules to protect the dolphins are no longer considered legal as a result of a trade agreement that we've entered into. Another example of this is candy-flavored cigarettes. Candy-flavored cigarettes. Now, we have spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars trying to prevent teens from being hooked on cigarettes. And you may have seen the ad yourself on TV. That's one of the things that we do in order to try to prevent that kind of interference in parenting. Well, the government eliminated all flavoring in cigarettes 2 years ago as a result of this effort to try to keep candy-flavored cigarettes out of the hands of children. The cigarette manufacturers sued, saying that was a restraint on their trade rights, and again, they won. So now it is once again legal to sell candy-flavored cigarettes to children. Obviously, there will be no end to this. Whether you're talking about health regulations, environmental regulations, safety regulations, and organizing regulations, whatever the laws might be, whatever the regulations might be, corporations are starting to use these trade agreements as a vehicle to throw out the laws that are meant to protect us from these corporations against whom we have no recourse. So they can sue our government to throw out our laws, but we can't sue them to enforce our laws. That's where this is, that's where it's heading. Now, with regard to these specific agreements, both the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Investment and Trade Partnership, with regard to both of these agreements, the Obama administration has deliberately taken the view that they don't want people to know about them. In both cases, when the agreements first were the subject of negotiation, in both cases, the administration voluntarily entered into an agreement with the other countries' negotiators that they would keep these agreements secret from us as they were negotiating them. Honestly, I'm not even sure what their legal authority is to do that. We've tried to look into it, we've tried to ask them, and we've gotten very unclear answers. But they thought that by making an agreement with the other countries that they keep it all secret, they could tie our hands as citizens, and we wouldn't be able to find out about it. Frankly, I don't know what's worse, not knowing what's in the agreement or what's in the agreement. Because to the extent we've been able to find out about these things, it's horrible. There's been no effort made in these agreements up to this point, as far as we can tell, to protect labor standards. A very basic thing. Now, you'd think that given the publicity involving the Chinese use of prison labor, something would be done about this. Nothing is being done about this. There's been no effort to protect environmental standards. China has some of the worst pollution in the entire world, and their people obviously can't do anything about it. So what they do is they produce these goods cheaply by polluting their own environment, because they know that we have higher standards here, they can get away with it there. That's one reason why production moves to China. No effort made whatsoever in these agreements to try to equalize environmental standards. Poor safety standards, you know, you've heard about over 1,000 Bangladeshis dying in garment factories to make the goods that we buy here in the United States. No effort at all to have occupational safety standards under these agreements. And on and on and on like that. Whatever the category might be, if it's for the good of the workers, for the good of the country, for the good of the people, there is no effort whatsoever in these agreements to try to enforce anything resembling international standards. It is, in fact, becoming a race to the bottom. So what's in them? Well, you might expect to find reductions of tariffs in these agreements. You might expect to find something resembling prohibition on taxing imported goods. Actually, we're way past that. Hardly anything gets taxed anymore when it comes to this country. There's nothing left to prohibit. Almost anything coming to this country now without any taxation, that's at all serious. No. Instead, what they're doing in these agreements is exactly what's been described. First of all, what's happening already in these agreements is that they're setting up more multinational tribunals, these investor state dispute resolution bodies, as they call them. And what these do is exactly what I just described. They're a vehicle for multinational corporations to sue sovereign nations like our own and win before these multinational tribunals, and then in doing so, either A, force us to repeal the law or regulation, or B, make us pay exorbitant amounts of money courtesy of taxpayers to subsidize them. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? One of the fundamental principles of law, both in America, in England, in virtually every country in the world, is called sovereign immunity. The sovereign cannot be sued in court. Period. Why is that? Because we make the laws, and the laws are imposed equally on everyone. So you cannot sue the sovereign in court. There's only one exception. You can only sue the sovereign in court if the sovereign approves. And on the basis of that one supposedly narrow exception, we have now opened the door and are continuing to open the door wide, really bust down the door, allowing multinational corporations to sue us to make our own laws illegal. What is the sense of that? Why would we ever be doing that? But that's become the fundamental purpose of both the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. It is, in essence, a fundamental waiver of our sovereign immunity solely for the benefit of multinational corporations and solely to throw out laws that are meant to protect us from them. That's it. That's what it's all about. So what we're doing basically is we are waiving our own sovereignty. We are throwing it away. We're tossing it away. And frankly, I don't really regard this as anything resembling a liberal issue or a left issue or even a trade union issue. I regard this as an issue that should be of concern to all Americans. Where is the Tea Party at? Why are they not shouting at the top of their lungs about these trade deals?
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Congressman Grayson. And now, a word from our sponsors, Legal Shield.
What is Legal Shield? It's total access. It's total freedom. Everyone deserves legal protection. And now, with Legal Shield, everyone can access it. No matter how traumatic, no matter how trivial, whatever your situation is, we are there to help. From real estate to divorce advice, identity theft, and beyond. Legal Shield has your rights covered. With Legal Shield, you'll be able to talk to a dedicated, experienced attorney about whatever you want, as often as you want, for less than $20 a month, no matter what happens. Legal Shield will have you protected and empowered to worry less and live more. Please visit www.mrsdd.com. That's www.mrsdd.com. Legal Shield.
So And that was Legal Shield. And now, Renee.
Thanks, Rick. Our first guest I'd like to bring on is Lorraine Tulliano. Lorraine is a graduate of the University of Central Florida with a degree in engineering. She works as a systems engineer with the Navy. Her interest in work and social justice led her to join and participate in the labor movement 20 years ago, working her way up through the American Federation of Government Employees and serving as its president from 1997 to 2010. Lorraine was elected vice president of government in the Central Florida AFL-CIO Central Labor Council and was elected to president of the Central Labor Council in 2010. Lorraine, I'm delighted you can join us. Obviously, the TPP, as NAFTA did, is going to have a huge impact on labor in this country. Tell us a little bit about your understanding and what your organization and people like you are doing in this arena.
Well, hi, Renee. Thank you for having me on. And thanks for having this program on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Well, American workers live in a global economic environment, right? Trade is increasing, and it's going to continue. So the key decision that we need our policymakers to make is not whether or not to increase trade, but what rules should govern trade, and who benefits from those rules. With that in mind, the AFL-CIO is really interested in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because it's representing President Obama's first opportunity to negotiate a trade agreement completely from scratch. So although this agreement is not finished yet, we don't see it taking a transformative approach that we need to make sure that it's the workers and not the 1% who will benefit. So a lot of this trade among the current TPP participants is already covered by free trade agreements, but it's designed, as you related, as an open-ended agreement. So countries like China and Burma and Japan are potentially new trading partners. So it's really important that we get this one right, so as it may govern the majority of our international trade in many years to come. So the world is still experiencing an economic slowdown, right, as a result of the 2008 financial crisis that we all went through. Our unemployment is close to 8%. Our families continue to face foreclosure. Employers continue to cut wages and benefits. And global corporations report record profits and pay record bonuses. Something's wrong with that picture. And it's not something that can be fixed by focusing on increasing our exports. Trade deficits matter. And American presidents keep pursuing new trade deals as if the next one will be the magic one, the one that creates jobs. Well, the workers are still waiting.
Right. Well, tell me, Lorraine, I mean, we saw the devastating effects of NAFTA. And it doesn't seem like we really need a trade agreement to encourage companies to ship jobs overseas. They're doing that anyway. From your standpoint, what is it that you think we need to see in this sort of agreement to protect labor and protect, you know, the people in your union as well as across the country?
Well, we don't need another trade agreement that hollows out our industrial base and adds to our trade deficit. We need a new model, one that addresses the ever-increasing income inequality you again addressed, that will strengthen our economy and promote our growth. We need a model that, instead of promoting a race to the bottom, which the current NAFTA model does, it allows the workers who create the wealth to share in the gains, no matter which country they work for.
Absolutely. Very important. What's going on in your union and the AFL-CIO? What are they doing, or are they doing anything at all with respect to the Trans-Pacific Partnership? What is their position?
Well, I believe we've testified at Congress. We have a very knowledgeable person who's a trade policy specialist, Celeste Drake, who's been testifying. They've issued a statement that's on their website, AFL-CIO.com, saying that we're not necessarily against the Trans-Pacific Partnership because the negotiations are taking place behind closed doors. It's secret meetings, so we don't know a whole lot about them. What we can say is we need a strategy that focuses on creating high-wage jobs for America that allows workers across the world to have a voice on the job.
And is there any activism, any groups that you're aware of that is trying to get these documents? It's my understanding that all this is being conducted in secret. Do you know of any work being done on that front?
I'm sure that there's been talks at the White House about this, keeping this secret. We've certainly expressed our concerns over what we need to see in a trade agreement. But again, like everyone else, we're waiting to see what happens. Now, what we've tried to do in Florida, there's a group called Floridians Against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, has been having workshops in the Central Florida area that I've attended. In fact, I was asked to sign on to a letter with our concerns on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And that's how the Central Labor Council got involved in this. That was back in April. And since then, we've had a workshop in Tampa and another one in Orlando, the one that Alan Grayson just, you had the tape from that workshop. So that's what's going on here in Florida.
Right. That was a very good meeting indeed. What about the Florida Growers Associations and you know, Florida is such a big agricultural state. What's your understanding of how these groups would be impacted and what is their position? Do you have any information on that?
I really don't. You heard Representative Grayson talk about corn exports to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
We're big in growing corn. We have subsidies, so our government subsidizes our farmers, which creates an unfair advantage for the workers in Mexico. And that's really what's happening around the world, where we have other countries such as China and Japan that unfairly subsidize certain areas of their economy that would make it virtually impossible for our workers to compete. So those are the kinds of things that need to be addressed.
Right. I know that was one of the issues with NAFTA. It decimated a lot of family farms, and it's not only here in the United States, but in Mexico as well. And, you know, one of the promises was that we were going to get lower price consumer products when, in fact, food prices have gone up in real terms 63% since NAFTA. I suspect that this is something that could repeat itself with this agreement.
Exactly.
Any other issues from your perspective before we bring on our next guest, Jim?
Well, the only thing is that we really look for basic worker rights, that the rights that we in the union and we as Americans believe are core to protecting all workers. So
Hello?
We want workers to have a right to free association and a right to join with other workers. We want to protect children. They lack the power and the knowledge to protect their own interests, and we do know that children work in other countries. They have to be protected from exploitation like we protect our children, and we want to make sure that there's no discrimination at work.
Okay. Lorraine, thank you very much. If you can hang on, we want to come back at the end and maybe have a little more discussion on this. But right now I want to bring on Jim Howe, member of the Communication Workers of America, Local 3108. He's a delegate to the Central Florida AFL-CIO. Jim has been very active in Floridians Against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and worked on events to raise awareness about the TPP, one held in March in Tampa and the one that Lorraine just mentioned in Orlando, where we had Congressman Grayson speak. He's currently working on another event to be held in Orlando in late July, and hopefully he'll have some more information on that for us. Jim, are you with us?
I am. Good evening, Renee.
Wonderful to have you. I'm so delighted you could join us on this important topic. Tell us a little bit about your work on this issue, what some of the salient points are that you think people need to know about the Trans-Pacific Partnership that they may not already know, and where we go from here.
All right, Renee. Well, thank you, first of all, very much for having this program and for inviting Greg Palast and for playing part of Congressman Grayson's talk at our last event here in Orlando. We really appreciate your support and showing up to cover that event. I know Elisa Simmons is going to be on with Public Citizen Global Trade Watch later in the program, and I do want to express my thanks to her for all the work she's done to getting Floridians Against the Trans-Pacific Partnership started and traveling around the state. And also Marjorie Holt with Sierra Club, who spoke at our last event. And Sierra Club has also been working with my union, Communications Workers of America, against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think the key issue that we have to face to tell us that this is something that is not in the interest of the American people is the fact that the administration is keeping the talk secret, keeping the content of the document secret. At our last meeting, Congressman Grayson mentioned that he was going to get to view one of the clauses in the Trans-Pacific Partnership in private, in his office, without his staff, without a pencil or any way to take notes. But that's the extent, and that's, as far as I know, that's still a promise and not something that's actually happened. But everything we do know about it is from leaks. And what we do know is that it's going to make jobs more difficult to obtain here in the United States at living wages, and it's going to make it easier for corporations to export jobs. It's going to undermine our government's ability to protect the environment and the health and safety of our people. It's going to stifle innovation by extending corporate control of patents and copyrights for much longer than they already have, and that in turn is going to increase drug prices by hindering generic producers from producing the generic drugs that we need. It will hinder government's ability to label products with their country of origin and the ingredients in the food that we eat. It will set up a system of kangaroo courts with corporate lawyers masquerading as impartial judges, which will trump local, state, and our federal government's laws. So just as an example, a chemical company could spill thousands of gallons of toxic waste next to your kid's school and then sue your local government for the cost of the cleanup because the cost would diminish its potential profit. This is the kind of outrageous behavior that we're seeing from the administration and from the 600 corporate sponsors that are privy to what is actually in the TPP agreement. I think we have to look at it as a natural outgrowth of what's been going on in our country for the past several decades in undermining the reforms that were passed under the Roosevelt administration to give us things like Social Security and unemployment insurance and the Glass-Steagall Act to rein in the power of the banks from wasting and speculating with our money. So we've had a long period of rollback from those gains of the 30s. The 1947, labor unions were crippled by the Taft-Hartley Act, and we are now down to only 11.3% of workers in this country organized within a trade union. And that's fallen another 0.5% to that level in just the last year. Minimum wages in general have not kept pace with inflation. The minimum wage would be a little more than $10 an hour now if it had kept pace with the minimum wage from 1968 and the inflation that followed. And if we'd kept pace with worker productivity, minimum wage would be at $16 an hour now. Over a million Americans have lost their jobs to NAFTA and the other trade agreements that have followed, and the World Trade Agreement, or World Trade Organization, rather. In 1999, the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed, which closed the door to some of the rampant speculation that caused the housing bubble and the recession that started in 2008. 3.4 million Americans have lost their homes since 2008. And this is only the foreclosures that are already on the books. Those that are still in progress are not counted in that number. The government bailed out the banks and is still giving the banks $85 billion a month through their easing campaign. That money alone would be enough to put every unemployed and underemployed worker in the United States back to work at a productive job making $30,000 a year. The Supreme Court, through Citizens United, gave corporations essentially the right to buy our politicians by sponsoring ads that undermine those politicians that they don't like. And now the corporations want to trump local, state, and national laws with their own kangaroo courts established under the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Democracy is the only way to combat corporate power. When the TPP can trump our national laws and our democracy, the only way for us to fight back is to mobilize working people and their allies and to stand up against this awful corporate power grab.
That's some very, very good information you've given us, Jim. I know that you have been at the forefront of this issue here in Florida, in particular, in trying to mobilize awareness on this issue. Tell us a little bit about your efforts. We know that you've had two meetings so far. You have a third one planned. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, we do expect another event. Congressman Grayson will be speaking again. I am still working on lining up speakers for that event. I think the most likely date would be July 29th here in Orlando. And people can certainly look at Floridian on Facebook at Floridians Against the Trans-Pacific Partnership to get the latest on what's going on with the TPP in general and what event we will be hosting here in Orlando probably July 29th.
Jim, this is Rick Spezak, News Director. I've got a quick question for you.
Certainly.
You mentioned that through the TPP, these corporations will have their own courts set up, and that these laws will supersede or render useless any state, county, even national law. Now, when you define a law as superseding any other authority, ultimately you're claiming the final authority to arbitrate matters, ultimately canceling sovereignty.
I think that that is quite evident, and I would refer you also to Congressman Grayson's website called TradeTreachery.com, where people can sign up to be involved, at least to the point of asking their congressional representatives and senators to provide information on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, information that the Congress and the Senate do not have. And I'll bring in the idea of fast track, which currently there is no fast track in place. But according to the Constitution, treaties in general, which a trade treaty, of course, is a subcategory of a treaty, they're supposed to be approved by a two-thirds majority of the Senate. The founding fathers thought that it was that important because these laws are going to take precedent over our local laws and our federal laws, and they're binding on the American citizenry. So they found it important enough to put it in the Constitution that it required a two-thirds vote of the Senate. Well, what we've done for NAFTA and many of the other trade treaties and the WTO is put it on what's called fast track, which simply means that instead of going through the normal constitutional process, the president would present a trade treaty to the Congress under fast track, and they would have a set amount of time to review it, and then either vote it up and down, up or down, with a 50% one majority, 50% plus one in both the House and the Senate. So just as an example, under NAFTA, you had a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, who put NAFTA through on fast track, basically with the votes of the Republicans in both houses and a few Democrats to put it over the top. And this is a much easier process than was envisioned in our Constitution. And these laws, because it is a trade agreement, they take precedence over our Constitution and our federal laws. Now, I think there's an argument that the whole idea of doing that is unconstitutional, but that is not stopping them from going forward with their process. And with the Constitution in the tatters that it has been put in lately, especially with our Fourth Amendment rights being trampled on by every person within the United States having their internet and their telephone conversations cataloged and tapped and available to be listened to at any moment, this really makes further shredded paper of the Constitution.
Thank you.
It's also my understanding that this will resurrect SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act that was killed due to all the outrage, and that the backdoor, the TPP is using as a backdoor avenue to get that introduced.
Also heard that from several sources, and if you give me a second here, I have some more information on that. Yeah, it would undermine our ability to use the internet because it would make it it would prohibit temporary files to be created. So when you go into a website to look at something and you want to, you know, post it on Facebook or share it with a friend, those temporary files that are created to facilitate that would be prohibited under the TPP. Secondly, it would eradicate privacy safeguards and allow the government and corporations to monitor our internet usage. It would allow media conglomerates to circumvent national legal systems and unilaterally fine users and ultimately take people off the internet, block them from using the internet for sharing information. And it would cause other countries to harmonize their laws with the very restrictive laws that are envisioned under the TPP. So it attacks internet freedom in numerous ways.
Yes, yes, I can see that. Jim, I want you to hang on, and we'll come back. I want to introduce our next guest on this topic, Alyssa Simmons. Alyssa is the National Field Director for Global Trade Watch. She's worked on a range of social and economic justice issues, including global trade, workers' rights, students' rights, LGBT, civil rights, and voter rights. Alyssa helped organize anti-WTO meetings in Seattle. She has a degree and certificates in sociology, liberal arts, international conflict resolution, and not-for-profit management. But Alyssa mostly credits her personal development and organizing success to the countless numbers of traditionally underrepresented and marginalized people. Alyssa, we're so delighted to have you on board. I know you've been at the forefront of the TPP. Public Citizen has been. You have your own website devoted to this issue. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Really, it's an honor to be with you all on a Sunday evening. I'm actually happy that this is the way I get to end my night. I want to first thank Jim and Lorraine for their extraordinary leadership in Florida and really taking you know, some meetings or teach-ins about the TPP and turning it into a really big issue with organizing on the ground and making it real. And that's part of my job as National Field Director, is just traveling across the country to educate people and also to provide backup support for all of the organizing work. So I applaud your efforts, and then thank you so much, Lorraine, for organizing this tonight and highlighting this issue, because it's really important. And what we are learning is that the more that people find out about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the more folks want to organize, and they're completely outraged that this is happening. And I also just want to thank you all for giving really great in-depth information. It makes my job a lot easier being the last speaker tonight. But I kind of want to hone in on a couple of things that you've already talked about and provide a little bit more information, if that's okay.
Please do.
Yeah. So specific to secrecy, which you have all talked about, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is being negotiated under extreme, unprecedented secrecy. Members of Congress don't have access to the text. Jim said earlier that it's their constitutional right to approve international trade agreements, but they don't even have access to this. The public has no access to the text. The press doesn't have any access to the text. But over 600 corporate advisors have access to the text. We're talking about corporations like Monsanto, Pfizer, Walmart, you get it, right?
And they're the ones that are actually negotiating the terms, are they not?
Absolutely. They have access to the text. They have special passwords where they can go in and give comment on it. And they are traveling around the world during these negotiation sessions and having influence over all of these negotiators from other countries. So this is absolutely unprecedented, completely unprecedented a level of secrecy. And, you know, Jim also said what we know, thank goodness, what we know is from the little amount of text that has been leaked, and what we've seen so far is really, really scary. That the information that we've been able to assess from the leaks leads us to believe that the Trans-Pacific Partnership really isn't about trade at all. I don't know about you all or your listeners, but when I think about trade, I think about exports, imports, tariffs, kind of, you know, the kind of boring things, right? The nitty-gritty things. What we're sold... And what we're sold by the administration, what we're told all the time about trade agreements, is exactly what Jim and Lorraine talked about specific to jobs. Oh, there's going to be an increase in manufacturing jobs. There'll be more, jobs into the United States, and what we've been able to see since NAFTA is that that's absolutely positively not true. There have been over 5 million net jobs, manufacturing jobs lost since NAFTA. And when we look at the NAFTA and all the trade agreements that have come after that, we look at a huge increase in trade deficits between the United States and these other countries. And I do urge all of you and all of your listeners to look at the Public Citizen website, tradewatch.org, specific to the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, just to look at the trade deficit that's increased. I mean, the numbers are appalling. And what we know is that the model that's being followed and that will be expanded immensely by the Trans-Pacific Partnership, what we know is that that model does not work. And that we need a model that encourages a race to the top, not a race to the bottom. And so going back to the fact that this is not about trade at all, this is really about, you know, sometimes when I talk about this, I feel like I get into conspiracy theory land, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all. But this really is, and we take a close look at it, and you learn, and you study, and you talk to other people, this is a grab by corporations to get the rules and the terms that they want so that they can continue to increase their profit margin. That's it. You talked earlier, someone talked earlier about SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. That is back in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They raised the issue. They tried to get it passed through Congress. Millions of people across the country rose up, and we won. We win, but they still find a backdoor way to get what they want in. And it's happening under the guise of free trade agreements. And we've really got to stop the TPP. This is unprecedented in its scope, in the terms of in what they're trying to cover, and also in the number of countries that are involved. There are 28 chapters that we know of. 29 chapters that we know of in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Only 5 of those chapters are about traditional trade issues. The other chapters are about the corporate takeover of public services. For example, there's a chapter on immigration. There's a chapter on food safety, or not food safety, not food safety, but food exports. There's a chapter on that's ironically called transparency, but's really about drug formularies and extending drug patents. And so when we all talk about and organize against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we're really stopping the corporate takeover of public services, the corporate takeover of everyday issues that impact our lives and that we care about very, very much. I want to just talk about the investor-state resolutions dispute system that you all talked about before, just to fill in a little bit. This is one of the things that gets me riled up personally, but a lot of people that I speak to across the country as well. The fact that there are these foreign tribunals that are set up that trump all domestic laws from the federal to the very local level. It's by a body of 3 judges who are not elected by anyone, who sometimes act as judges in this system, but who also sometimes act as lawyers representing the corporations. There's no mechanism. There's not even the pretense that consumer rights are even taken into account. It's a completely corporate body that's set up to represent and to make sure that corporate interests are taken care of.
So let me just interrupt you here for a moment, Alyssa. So corporations can take their grievances to these tribunals and claim damages for lost profits, but citizens and unions and consumer groups and even governments do not have access to these tribunals. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. That is absolutely correct. And corporations can bring a suit against the country for, quote, expected future profit, end quote.
Profit futures. That's,
yes. So what they think their profits would have been in the future. Mm-hmm. That's what they can do. And Renee, you gave a great, I just have to say, you gave a really great introduction to the TPP earlier. And one of the things that you said about investor state specifically was you talked about the money that's been paid out. And when we talk about that money, I just want to kind of bring it home for folks, right? First of all, this system isn't new, right? Renee, you talked about it being part of NAFTA, and since NAFTA, we've had trade agreements with Peru, for example, with Korea, et cetera. And so this investor-state system has already existed. What the Trans-Pacific Partnership does is elevate corporations to the level of sovereign nations. So under the WTO, for example, a country could bring suit against another country. But with investor state, a corporation can bring suit against an entire country. And when we talk about the country paying money out to the corporations for expected future profits, we're talking about our tax dollars. We're talking about the money that the federal government takes from workers, right, to provide services. Corporations get to steal that money from us for expected future profits. And so far, under these tribunals, there's been over $3.5 billion paid out worldwide. These payments are based on toxic bans, land use policies, forestry rules, health, the environment, right? So they're attacking the things that we fight for. When we say, you know, we want to get together and have these laws that protect our environment, that protect worker safety, that protect land use policies, and then the corporations can't beat us through Congress, right, through the democratic mechanism in which our country is founded, they turn around and use these trade agreements through the back door to try to get money for breaking those rules. There are also, so $3.5 billion have been already paid out to these corporations worldwide. But right now, there are more than $14.7 billion in pending claims over these trade agreements. Now, even if in the rare case that a government wins against a corporation, the government is responsible to pay the legal fees for the tribunal's costs, which average about $8 million per case. So no matter what, millions of dollars and sometimes billions of dollars, potentially billions of dollars, I mean potentially any number of our tax dollars are given to corporations. And I also want to talk about fast track, but I feel like I've been talking for a while, so I want to stop and make sure
someone has a question. This is really important. So what I'm hearing is that there is actually an incentive built into these negotiations to encourage companies to sue governments. If they're not on the hook for any financial costs, if they fail.
Exactly.
I wish we all had that benefit. and, you know, I want to take a break right here, Alyssa. Please don't go away because there's a lot more that I want to have you talk about. But I think this is a good point to bring in the Sierra Club piece that they did on what the TPP would do for fracking in this country.
Mm-hmm.
They have a fact sheet, and if I could just briefly read from this. One of the dirtiest secrets of the TPP is its potential to pave the way for dramatically increased fracking across the United States. In order for the United States to expand natural gas to another country, the Department of Energy must first conduct a thorough public analysis to determine whether those exports are consistent with the public interest. This analysis is critical to understanding the environmental and economic impacts associated with natural gas exports and to building a deliberate energy policy that protects the interests of the American public. Unfortunately, the Department of Energy loses its authority to regulate exports of natural gas to countries with which the United States has a free trade agreement that includes so-called national treatment for trade in gas. The TPP, therefore, could mean automatic approval of liquid natural gas export permits without any review or consideration to any TPP country. And many TPP countries would likely be quite interested in importing liquid natural gas from the United States. This is particularly true of Japan, the world's single largest liquid natural gas importer, which has, as we just announced, just joined the talks. Already the Department of Energy is considering application to export approximately 45% of the total U.S. domestic gas production in the United States. So what we're seeing here is that in anticipation of this agreement, we're already seeing an increase in export applications that these exports, as well as imports into the United States, would bypass the regulatory requirements, environmental and economic, that are currently required. And it would also allow a complete dismantling of any national policy that we have on energy. I mean, isn't that supposed to be one of the big things where we've been working on is energy independence, and now we're exporting so much of this? So I think this is a good example of how one issue in particular, and one issue that most people in this country are vehemently opposed to, can use the TPP to bypass our laws and our national policies. Alyssa, you wanted to go on and talk some more. Please continue.
No, yeah, you're absolutely right, and I think you gave a great example. I just want to just talk about a few more of the cases that are underway right now, so we have an understanding of what is at stake. Right now, Chevron is trying to evade liability for its Ecuadorian Amazon toxic contamination. That's being that's underway in one of these investor state tribunals. Philip Morris is attacking Australia's cigarette labeling policy. Eli Lilly, a drug company, is attacking Canada's drug patent policy. And now we're finding that European firms are attacking Egypt's post-revolution minimum wage increase and South Africa's post-apartheid affirmative action laws. So this is, it's evasive what the corporations are attacking. Given this power, they really feel like they can attack anything. And again, these are all of the things that we have fought for decades, and are still fighting today for. So again,
Alyssa,
a backdoor way
ask you a question.
For corporations to do that. Yes.
This is Rick Spezak, news director. Alyssa, you mentioned briefly Fast Track. We know that Fast Track is going to be trying to slip this thing through quickly. Who are our allies in Congress besides Congressman Grayson, who's going to work to stop this?
Well, we have a few allies. It's kind of hard for me to talk about strategy in a public forum, but some
sure.
folks who have been champions in the past, Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio has been really, really great. Representative Rosa DeLauro is also a leader on this. And so people have come forward, members of Congress have come forward, and there will be, I'll give you a little bit of a sneak, there will be a letter coming out not too far from now from a lot of the freshmen in Congress saying that they oppose Fast Track and that they came into Congress, they understand their constitutional right, their constitutional authority, and that negotiating trade agreements is one of them. And so the momentum is building for Congress to really have the power over negotiating and approving the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that's great. That's great. If I can, for just one more minute, talk about Fast Track, I want to just highlight the things that are given away under Fast Track. So constitutionally, as a lot of people have said before, Congress is given the right to negotiate and approve trade agreements. Under Fast Track, which was an idea that came up, or that Nixon brought forth and was approved to grab power, right? Fast Track, let's understand, it's a power grab by the president and the administration to fast track any kind of trade deals without congressional oversight, right? So that started in Nixon. Until then, we're fine for 200 years with Congress having this authority in negotiating trade deals. But under Fast Track, these are the powers that Congress gives away to the president: the power to select trade partners, the power to set terms and sign agreements before Congress gets to vote on them, the power to write, the administration actually gets the power to write legislation to change all U.S. laws, and it completely skirts congressional review. This is one of the only cases where legislation comes from the administrative branch. That is absolutely Congress's power. The administration also gets the power to force votes within 60 to 90 days of submitting the legislation to Congress. And also, the administration gets to override normal voting rules through Fast Track. All amendments on Fast Track are banned, and debate is severely limited, including the United States Senate. So this is the severity of what Fast Track does. And one of the things that we're doing at Public Citizen right now is we're engaged in a fight against Fast Track. And before I stop speaking, I just want to say really quickly, we have two websites specific to the TPP and that I want to promote. One is expose.org. Please go there. Look for more information. We have fact sheets on a number of issues, including workers' rights, the environment, et cetera. But if you really want to dive into Fast Track, you can also check out fasttrackhistory.org. Our executive director, Lori Wallach, the executive director of Global Trade Watch, just revised her book on Fast Track, and you can find out a lot of information about what this means for trade agreements and what this means for democracy there. So I'll stop there and then again just thank all of you for this conversation, and specifically Renee for inviting me and for all of you for the great work that you're doing on the ground.
Good, good stuff, Alyssa. Don't go away. I have a question I want to ask you, but I want to make sure everybody gets those websites. It's expose.org. Highly recommended. I've been on the site. It's full of great information, easy to use, easy to understand, easy to follow. It'll tell you in a nutshell what you need to know. And give us the other one again, Alyssa.
The other one is fasttrackhistory.org.
Okay. Make a note of those. Alyssa, I have a question, and it has to do with, very quickly, strategy here. Given the fact that the Republicans have basically shot down anything that comes from the White House in Congress, what are the chances of them actually doing so in this case?
That's a really great question, Renee. And here's the deal. Right? Here's the we think about that all the time, and we think, oh, okay, we've kind of got it in the bag, and this will not be so much of a fight. But what this comes down to, because this is really about corporate takeover, right, and what the corporations want, and money, and greed, and politics, and all of that, right, that we've been dealing with for decades, I'm going to be blunt, will the Republicans' hatred or suspicion or whatever you want to call it, of President Obama outweigh the pressures that they're going to get from the corporations who put them in power?
That's the million-dollar question.
That's the million-dollar question. And what it's going to take is, and people in each state standing up against this and holding their elected representatives in Congress accountable. And I just want to say that this seems insurmountable, and it seems crazy and overwhelming, but I do want to say that we've won before, and we can win again. You know, with the WTO and that big resistance that, you know, by the way, we couldn't do without folks like Lorraine and Jim, because labor is a huge part of fighting back the bad trade agreements. Right? So the WTO has been really kind of in limbo since the Doha round. They've not had much progression. So I think that we can count that as a success. The FTAA in early 2000s, the Free Trade of the Americas Agreement, that was completely blown up by people in the streets in Miami. There were over 20,000, I think close to 30,000 people that came out against it and, you know, and put themselves on the line and said no. And so this seems insurmountable, but we can absolutely do it. We just have to continue the education and continue organizing in our communities.
Well, I think one thing we have going for us, and this is on your own website on NAFTA, how, you know, now that we have the history of NAFTA behind us, public sentiment is definitely against this sort of trade deal. If I'm reading this correctly, most of the public opinion in polls have a majority of Americans either wanting us to leave NAFTA or renegotiate it. So it's a matter of getting information out there about the existence of the TPP and letting it speak for itself, more or less. And people hopefully will recognize this as the evil monster that it truly is. I want to make one last plug. I noticed in the New York Times a couple days ago there was an excellent article by your executive director on this very topic. So for you New York Times readers, I think it was about 3 days ago, you can check that out as well. That was an excellent piece. We have only a minute left, and unfortunately we don't have time for any questions, but in 30 seconds or less, Lorraine, any last comments you'd like to leave us with?
Yes. I just want to go back to this investor-state dispute settlement mechanism that wasn't brought out, but it's so important. The standard of review in this investor-state. In the U.S. courts, we generally have the good of the public can be weighed against the private right to make a profit. And sometimes the public wins. In these disputes, in these investor state disputes, that standard is not going to apply.
Mm.
So profit's going to rule over everything.
Jim, any last comments you'd like to leave with us?
Two. One is the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. Gives Congress the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations. Should this be passed, they would be giving up that right. Secondly, President Obama, when he was a candidate back in 2008, campaigned around the idea that he would renegotiate NAFTA with environmental and workers' protection. And as far as I know, that hasn't happened. And this is doubling down in the opposite direction by giving even more power to corporations. And the only way we're going to stop this is for masses of people to get out in the streets, become aware of it, and become willing to take action. And I applaud you, Renee, and the other speakers for being involved and getting the word out, because I think we still have an uphill battle to wake people up about the fact that this is even going on.
Okay. I'm sorry, we are out of time. Lissa, thank you. Jim, thank you. Lorraine, thank you so much. This has been great. You guys have been wonderful. Please keep us posted, and we'll keep our listeners posted on this very important issue. Rick, you want to wrap it up for us?
Yes, I want to thank our colleagues, Gwen Holden-Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, Anita Stewart and her Wise Women Media, Brian Stetton, his Progress Toward Democracy, Susan Nylon, The Nylon Report, Sita Beguil and the Sita Media, and Emily Dillick and her Progressive News. Thanks for listening. Join us next week, another fantastic show. Thank you, our guests. We appreciate the information you've been giving. It is crucial information for all Americans. Thanks again. And thank you, Renee. Awesome job. And here we go with some out music. Ladies and gentlemen, We don't want your milk.
Call me green or blue or red. This one thing I sure know, mister. My hungry babies must be fed. Take the two old parties, mister. No different in them I can see. But with a farmer labor party, we could set the people free.
Next week, Big D Democrats and Little D Democrats. Tune in next Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, when Renee and I bring you a little more progressive information. Thanks again, Rick Spezak, News Director, and Renee, thank you so much. Good night, folks.